not. We totally raised money on a dream. The three founders all got together and said, if we can raise X amount of money, then we'll feel comfortable quitting our jobs. And once we raised that money, we quit and we started working on Transect. And Transect was actually in R&D for 2 years before we got our first contract, because I wanted it to be better than what I was providing as a consultant.
Okay. Welcome back to the Clean Techies podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, Silas and I chat with Robin Lane, CEO and founder of Transect, a product that aids and expedites site selection for infrastructure projects. For Silas and I, this was an exciting mix of infrastructure meeting technology. Robin has been doing this for a while, so she had a lot to tell us about her experiences with developers, rolling Transect out to market, how she grew as a founder alongside her company, and what she sees for the future. We were really happy to have her on and learn a lot of new things about site selection and the problems plaguing infrastructure projects today, a major component of increasing the supply of new renewables and advancing the climate transition. As always, thanks so much for listening and enjoy the episode.
All right, welcome to the show, Robin. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super, super excited to have you. I think it's not every day that we have a technology player that serves the renewable energy industry. So I think it's going to be pretty interesting to talk to you, since I know quite a bit about that, having done recruitment in the space. So give us a quick intro, kind of just a really high level summary of what you're doing today at Transect.
Sure. So Transect is helping renewable energy developers to find and assess the right site to build on in minutes. Our platform combines over 75 years of consulting intelligence with 1,000+ public and proprietary data sets in an easy to use online platform that helps make site selection easy.
Hey there. Are you building a climate tech business and looking for very specialized talent? Consider reaching out to our sponsors, NextWave Partners. NextWave are experts in talent acquisition, recruitment, and retention across the climate tech, renewables, and ESG spaces globally. So if your team is growing or you're looking to make a career change yourself, feel free to reach out to NextWave at next-wavepartners.com or reach out to one of their consultants directly via their LinkedIn page. Okay, very good. I think we'll get into the nuances of that in a bit. But I guess, can you talk more about the problem you're solving, right? So just kind of high level, what's the problem? How'd you identify it? And let's go into that.
Yeah, for sure. I'll give it a tiny bit of kind of background and why we're trying to solve this problem and kind of how I figured out this was a problem. So my background is in environmental consulting for land developers. After spending the first decade or so of my career at three different traditional environmental consulting firms, it was pretty clear that the industry that's kind of historically done environmental permitting was really ripe for transformation. It's repetitive, it's error prone, it's expensive. And that had negative knock-on effects for our developers, for the success of our developers' projects. And so we originally kind of had this idea of, is there a way to make this industry better, and do our clients feel like there is a problem with this industry? So we kind of validated that by doing speaking with a dozen or so of land developer clients. Like, is this part of the process a problem for you? And we identified it was, so we knew we were onto something. Right now, we are largely serving the renewable space, which is kind of why we're here chatting today. So as it relates to our position in the renewables market, we know now that one of the biggest barriers to the clean energy transition is permitting. It's shown to be one of the most deadly, really. In order to meet our energy transition goals, we need to develop land the size of, I've seen a few different states, right? Like Wyoming and Colorado combined, or South Dakota, or whatever. A lot of land is needed. And all of that does have an impact, even if it's for the energy transition. The Brookings Institute, the Wall Street Journal, the White House have all cited permitting as a big problem and how it takes way too long and it's way too risky. And we've confirmed this with our clients too. It's just a big bottleneck. And so that's what our platform is trying to help solve.
Mm-hmm. So can you talk more about, I guess, that specific, because there's many permits involved in developing. Let's just kind of focus on solar, right? Because that's the primary focus of what you work on, correct? So
that's right.
Within that, generally speaking, obviously it probably depends on state, but how many permits are actually required?
Yeah, it can definitely depend on the, closer to the coasts where you have a federal, state, and local permitting bodies that are all pretty involved in the development process. There could be upwards of 30 different environmental or land permits that are needed. Middle of the country, we get somewhere closer to 10 or 15. But still, quite a few land-based, kind of environmental-based permits are required no matter where we are in the country.
And what is the typical, I guess, maybe it's difficult to categorize broadly, but how long does it usually take, let's say in a kind of a, let's say Texas, for example, how long does it take to get those permits achieved so you can kind of put the steel in the ground?
Yeah, so again, it really depends on what you have on your site. If you're on a site that doesn't have a whole lot of environmental impact, you could get your permitting done in 3 to 6 months. If you're on a site that has a lot of environmental impact, it might take upwards of 2 years. And that's why we at TransAct, and part of our mission is to balance that conservation of the natural world with the needs of the built world. Because usually what's good for the environment is also good for business. We promote avoidance and minimization strategies here because we know that if, you know, by avoiding environmental impact, you're probably minimizing that permit timeline as well.
Yeah, okay, got it. So then, I guess broadly speaking, for people who aren't familiar, I'll try to summarize this and you correct me if I've got any of this wrong, but when you're building these projects, you need to have the permits in place. You need to make sure that there's obviously capacity on the grid for it. And then, of course, if it's solar, that there's enough sun, right? And you can do the layouts properly.
Right.
So your angle is helping them identify these the correct sites. So where is the major time savings coming from? Because you're streamlining it and probably making it much more cost effective, but time-wise, is it mostly in just kind of knocking off the ones from the list that are really a bad site to go with in the first place? Or is there also time savings throughout the application process that you're helping with?
It could be a little bit of both. So we know that the traditional old way that I came from, the consulting world, it would take 2 to 3 weeks sometimes to turn around just a first look at a particular project site. Like I'm a developer, I'm sending it to a consultant. What are my big red flags? Coming from the consulting world, I understand the cost and the time that went into that, and that's some of the hours I wanted to minimize. So from that perspective, we know that, you know, like we have our clients, we estimate internally that we've probably saved them over $15 million and 800,000 plus hours, kind of in a 1 year cycle, of collectively on how much time we have saved the industry in this space. But then there's also the opportunity cost of not building on the wrong site. The Nature Conservancy actually came out with a really interesting study recently and showed that when you have a low impact site, as in you're choosing a site that has lower environmental impact, that permitting can be up to 3 times faster. They say 13 months versus 35 months in some cases, and a
Wow.
project cost 7 to 14% lower when those sites when projects are sited in areas of low biodiversity value. So we've seen it anecdotally with our customers, and then we know that making a choice to have a low impact, to choose a low impact site, can have really big positive knock-on effects for the success of the project.
Yeah, okay. That's quite interesting. Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because someone and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort, and it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show.
What is the main, you think, resistance from anyone who's looking to onboard this product? The reason I say that is because I could see that there's a little bit of trust involved with having someone else maybe do the advisory for you, do the trust for you. It's kind of already baked in, it sounds like, but have you encountered resistance in that way that people don't really understand how you're verifying and you have to make that explanation? Or do people kind of just assume that you're doing the right thing?
Yeah, we've been in the market long enough. I feel like we have a bit of street cred at this point in time. We do have a full deck of regional specialists on our team that have built this platform and service this platform and are available to our customers. But there is some level of objection handling we have to do because when a developer who's not familiar with TransAct, you say the word environmental or permitting to them, the thought bubble that pops in their head is a person. They're not used to it being a technology platform. And so, and that's really where introducing them to our experts. We actually have kind of an expert in your pocket feature where if you have questions about what's in the app, we'll meet with you as part of the service. As part of our demos, we'll run a site in through our platform they're familiar with, so they can almost do an apples to apples comparison of maybe what a consultant produced for them versus what Transect can produce for them in, you know, weeks versus minutes. So there's a little bit of proving that we have to do there, but the success of our company feels like we've won over their confidence.
Right. And are there any, this is probably a little bit of a dated question, but when you were first doing this, have there been any difficulties in scaling this kind of a trust-based or communication-based model? The reason I say that is because I think when you're hiring different types of customer success people, those kinds of relationships, that kind of experience can be a little tough. And I feel like we don't really talk about that scaling that much in climate because I don't think a lot of people are dealing with it. But for the people that are, especially in renewables, I think it's not an area that has a lot of content and discussion on. So how is that process for you?
Just to clarify, so you're asking how did we build kind of that trust in the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. this is an interesting story. We learned that the hard way, honestly. We came out of the gates with a couple of really nice clients and a couple of really nice contracts, one of which actually churned after the first year because we did not provide them with that level of customer success and customer service that we later learned our customers needed. We were not customer obsessed back then. We thought that the app would function on its own. They did. We had a relationship enough with them. We assumed they would trust the app, but we did not do enough handholding back then, and enough. We did not give them enough resources and make ourselves available enough that they ended up turning in. And that was a really hard lesson to learn early on. So since then, we've always had a theme around customer success and customer obsession.
And what do you think was like the main catalyst behind that? Was that sort of top down, you saying, hey, like our customers are our number one, or where did that change come from?
Being customer obsessed?
Yes.
I think it's come from a couple of places. That as a founder, having one of my first couple contracts churn, and it was a nice contract, having that churn hurt. So there was like definitely some pain points there. But also as the industry has advanced and as there are other vertical SaaS solutions, there aren't any that focus on environmental like we do, but there's other vertical SaaS solutions in the space. We just have maintained that we really want to be best available and continue to understand what our client pain points are. So the best way to grow our business is to be client obsessed. And so when we sit around in a room going, what product should we build next, right? It's like, well, let's ask the customer. And so it evolved a little bit from a business need and then also from that pain point of losing a customer when we weren't paying attention to what they wanted.
That's great to hear. I mean, a lot of times you deal with certain founding teams that are convinced that they're right and the market's not. And it's not to say that that's wrong. I think there are some market shaping technologies that change the way people interact. But I don't think that climate is really there because a lot of times there's still a lot of spaces that need product market fit. And you need to listen to your customers who have been in the space for a long time. So it's really good to hear how responsive you were.
Yeah, there's that old adage of like, had Henry Ford asked everybody what they wanted, everybody would have said a faster horse and he not a car, right? And so it's like it's a delicate balance of forward thinking about what the customer probably hasn't thought of yet versus understanding what they need. Okay. And that's the challenge for our leadership team that we're always navigating.
Very cool.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to understand the fine line between providing something totally new, but that is still close enough to understand that they'll adopt it, right? Because if it's completely out of the box, this is why a lot of these, you know, big thinkers talk about, you know, changing the workplace and nobody will have real jobs, it's between contracts, whatever. None of these things happen because it's so far, the space between existing and the future is so far. Kind of managing that fine line is great. I really do like the story you told about the customer service thing, because I think there's a lot of founders, not necessarily in climate that I've heard of, that really, once they landed that first contract, they were like, we got to do everything to make this the best experience, right? Because we've only got one paying customer initially. We'll do everything we can to make it work, because then they're going to tell their friends, right? Nobody else is going to get maybe the exact same level of first class service per se, but at least we're doing a good job and making it extra special for them. So I like this. In terms of, you know, I want to back up a little bit. When we look at your career, kind of from an outsider's perspective, it looks very focused, right? Kind of very, very focused career Did you plan it this way? And, you know, kind of were there any possible, I guess, times when you weren't certain about the direction of your career?
I plan it this way, but I am really passionate about environmental conservation. That was always something I knew I was passionate about. I have a ecology degree. And I think that I've learned over time that promoting conservation from the regulatory and the business benefit perspective is a really practical way to make an impact. Just maximize those opportunities and kind of reach towards mastering my craft. I really love being a student of this industry. There's a lot of change, so there's always something to learn and engage with. It's never boring. Again, I didn't really mean to be so focused, but I did end up kind of mastering this craft, and it feels like a space where I can make an impact. So I'm here, but we'll see what happens in the future.
I'm curious. I think one of the main things that inspires me is how multifaceted you need to be in climate. And the people who develop that multifaceted personality have a lot of options about what they want to do. So I think I want to take what you're saying and put it in reference of how did you decide that I want to be the one tackling a problem, right? Because you can sort of stay abreast of it, be in these different services, different firms. How did you decide that I want to be boots on the ground and be an entrepreneur?
Yeah. How did I decide I want to be an entrepreneur? I don't know that I definitely decided like later in my career that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I'm not the traditional kind of like big out there CEO founder type really personality. But I think that once I just took to consulting. I think it's really interesting. It's like problem solving. It's like a treasure hunt of trying to figure out what's on the site and then how we can get it permitted. Understanding the rules and regulations are so nuanced, and I'm kind of a detail-oriented person, that I feel like once I kind of had some mastery of this craft and felt really confident, it all of a sudden just kind of became more appealing to strike out on my own and solve a problem. And at the time when I thought of Transect, it was really at a crossroads of how GIS, geographic information systems, which is the mapping tools that we use for listeners that aren't familiar with that term, was really starting to have a lot more capabilities. And we were also starting to see a lot more of the publicly available data digitized. We were having more resources from the state agencies. And so it felt like it was all kind of coming into a culmination of the tools are starting to be in place to solve a problem using technology. And I think the only person who could have solved this problem is someone with a background like me, because you really have to have the knowledge of the specialty regulations in the background and like why it matters to the land developer clients.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show. So the thing I'm really curious about with people who come from this kind of consulting background, and they obviously understand the problems deeply, they have great content understanding. So it sounds like there was some level of technology being used and you just decided, you know what, that could be something I work on, because you weren't coming at it from a tech first perspective. But then you decided to build a tech company like as a consultant. How did that kind of play out in your mind of deciding, you know what, I'm willing to go bring in people who know how to build tech and we're going to do this?
Yeah. So one of the first steps that when I was a consultant, my land developer clients would always call me for is they would call me and say, hey, Robin, I'm thinking about building this 800-acre residential community in north of Austin, Texas, where I live. Can you tell me what are the environmental problems on this site? Because before they move forward, they just need to know, right? In early stages. And we would do a lot of research to figure that out. We would look at probably 30 to 50 different documents that looked at species and cultural resources and hazardous materials and regulations and waters and all sorts of different things. And then we put together a PDF document that says, here's probably the things that are wrong with the site. And then they'd say, cool, now can we pay you to tell us what to do about it, right? And so it was just this very manual analog process. But we had to do it for every single project. And you know, I worked in several industries that were kind of in boom times. And so we didn't really have 2 or 3 weeks to produce these. They wanted the answers yesterday, if you will. And so the basis technology that we were using for all this was a program called ArcMap, which is Esri. It's still a very popular program, and we still use it here in-house. And so we were also doing a lot of like GISing and map making and, I don't know, trying to display the results of what we knew on a map for our client. And this process did typically take, depending on how long the project was, like a few days to a few weeks. It was expensive. And that was, and oftentimes actually as consultants, we were doing it for free, like trying to win the job later. And so this particular process is the first one that I identified that was like, we can automate this. We have GIS, we have data, we can create more data, we can digitize more data, we can make proprietary data sets, and we can take what I know about it. So just because I see a wetland on a site, on a map, right? I'm the one with having either to go memorize the regulations or because I know it because of my experience, that you have to minimize your impacts to less than a tenth of an acre, or you have to bore under it, or you have to get this permit, and here's the timeline in which you can do that, right? We put all that in a database and combine that with the GIS, it could spit out an answer in just a couple seconds, right? And that was actually our MVP, was can you draw a line on a map, have it pick the right piece of like content that applies right to that piece of data and show that to the client, show that to the customer. And so, yeah, that was kind of the seed. And then it just kind of took off from there when we started thinking about what other problems can we solve for our clients. But that was our flagship product, and that's what we originally raised our money on.
So the product was originally made sort of in-house after doing all of this back and forth processing, back and forth manual testing?
Was it made in-house? I think the inspiration for the project happened while I was in consulting. Mm-hmm. If you mean in-house, it happened in-house at Transact, right? That's when I got a couple co-founders together, and we decided to see if this was viable. So we tested it with some of my old clients. We made the MVP, and we went out to see if we could raise a little bit of money to do it.
Very cool. And this is particularly exciting for me because I am a huge geospatial data enthusiast. I did a lot of work in mapping orchards and agriculture, specifically for like different growth patterns. So I worked a lot with satellite imagery. And I think geospatial data is really interesting because there's a level of estimation in every geospatial data product, right? Because you're dealing with different resolutions, different data sources that you have to clean and map together. So I'm curious, what made you feel like the data product that you were building, how did you validate whether it was working or not? I mean, you were with this manual process and giving answers. But at some point with geospatial data, you have to essentially say, okay, I'm comfortable with this estimation. So was that kind of grant something that happened naturally? Or did you go through some specific process to decide, okay, you know what, this is like a good enough product now?
Yeah. We've largely validated it with our customers. And we still do validate it with our customers on every single time we do a sales demo. We say, send, like I mentioned earlier, send us a project that you're familiar with. What did a consultant find versus what has Transact found? And it always matches. So mostly customer validation is how we quality control.
Okay, great. One thing that I guess is my favorite part of people's stories usually is going from having a job to being an entrepreneur. So you mentioned that you guys developed this with some co-founders. Did you just decide, okay, I want to do this and we're going to build software around it. So let's get together these people and we're going to start our own consulting firm initially and then kind of flip it into a software business. Is that how you started? I just want to understand that kind of mental, crossing the river from job to entrepreneur.
Yeah, no, we did not start as a consulting firm. We had the idea of the actual tech company. We did the MVP very, very early. We all got together actually in a hot tub. That's the origination of Transact. Is one of my original co-founders was a brilliant engineer. And so we were all sitting in the hot tub ideating, and he was working on the MVP in the hot tub at our old house. And it never started as a consulting firm. We always knew we wanted to be a tech company. So once we had that MVP, we knew it was possible. That's when we kind of started looking at how we form a company. We hadn't even formed a company yet. I think we were all still working full-time jobs elsewhere. Started exploring if if anybody we knew would maybe give us money, you know, kind of raising on a dream. And once we kind of validated those two things, that's when we started Transect. But it's always been a full-blown tech company.
Okay, nice. So that's the part I want to understand is a lot of people like try to build something while they keep their jobs. And then they're like, okay, we got the time that we can, you know, we've got a contract and so we can go towards it. So can you continue on that, right? So you had validated the idea by building a bit of an MVP, testing it out with some people. And then did you have a contract in place or at least commitments before you were able to raise money? Can you talk about that?
We did not. We totally raised money on a dream. The three founders all got together and said, if we can raise X amount of money, then we'll feel comfortable quitting our jobs. And once we raised that money, we quit and we started working on Transect. And Transect was actually in R&D for 2 years before we got our first contract because I wanted it to be better than what I was providing as a consultant. And okay. So it was 2 years before we got our first contract. So the amount of money that we raised got us through that first couple years.
Okay, that's great. So I guess can you continue? I just want to understand the growth of the company, right? So you developed it, you got it really nice, you got the product great, and then you got a couple contracts. And just talk us through that next phases of growing, maybe some of the growing pains. And then when you got to a point where you maybe went out and raised a larger amount of money and started really hiring the team and really kind of taking off.
So let's see, we got our first couple of clients. We lost our first big client, which I talked about earlier because of customer success. And this was all pre-COVID. And so we were all in house here in the Central Texas area working together. And we originally started off as multi-industry. So we just had, you know, we had a sales guy. I think we had like a kind of a chief of staff or kind of like who also had environmental experience. We're kind of starting to build our staff. We were maybe a team of, we went to market in January of 2019. So by 2020, we were maybe a team of 10 or 12 or something like that, kind of all in-house and really just kind of hitting the pavement to every conference we could go to, every list of developers in any industry. We were kind of, it was kind of a smattering of figuring out what our target industry was at the time. And just trying to figure out what would stick doing the thing before we ran out of money. But with the first few contracts that we got, we were fortunate enough to have an absolutely amazing climate tech fund hear about us through a demo prospect that we were on. They came to us and offered us kind of our first round of venture funding. And us, like, you know, the naive founders we were, we're like, oh no, we're going to be profitable. We don't need to take institutional funding. We're going to totally make this. We're going to be cash positive, you know, because we had all these great contracts, but they were all early adopters. But they were like, no, we like what you're doing. You really should take our money. And so we ended up taking it and we closed that round the week we all got sent home for COVID, which was absolutely amazing and very lucky, but also speaks highly to the fact that the investors yeah. that are partners with us were just wonderful people, that they kind of pursued us even through that COVID process. So, yeah. And then from there, I think we really started to scale after we closed that initial round.
Before we get to that, you said that they heard about you. And I think usually these connections are more serendipitous than anything. But so yeah. What does hearing about you mean? Did you ever get to talking about that?
I did. Yeah. So we were demoing a renewable energy developer who was a fairly small shop at the time. They did not end up signing up for Transect as a subscriber then, although they are now a Transect subscriber. But he said, I like your platform. We can't sign up for it today, but I have a friend in venture who I think would be interested in your platform. So he made a warm introduction and that's how we got connected.
Nice. So it sounds like there's some hesitations in some cases, but generally speaking, since there wasn't necessarily a whole lot of technology for the industry at the time you guys were getting into this, I mean, it's becoming more popular now, right? We're seeing other companies doing this. How was the reception to using tech? Because I mean, I've worked with a lot of developers as a recruiter, right? They're a lot of times they're pretty old school, right? They go out and they meet people, they shake hands. Like how are they receptive to technology?
Yeah. I think Transect's path has followed the traditional what they call the marketing bell curve, where at the very beginning, we have those early innovators. That's the kind of people that have the mindset that they're going to line up outside the Apple store when the new phone comes out. They just like technology. And we, those are a bit the low-hanging fruit, right? Like, we kind of talked to everybody that we could and found that a first initial cohort of people who just loved the idea of using technology and felt like it gave them a competitive advantage. That's kind of how we started. Once you have those contracts and those logos, then you can start going after kind of the next early adopter chunk, which are the ones that want to see who else in their industry is using it. What are the case studies? How are they using it? We were better able to define our pricing and our packaging at that point in time. And so by then we had the right pieces to start going after those like slightly more skeptical buyers. So it's, yeah, it kind of followed a very traditional marketing bell curve for us.
Yeah, I think it's really great to be able to look back at your growth through that process, because I think a lot of people, it's very difficult, regardless of how thoughtful you are, to be in the moment thinking, all right, we know exactly who our early adopters are, right? You have to talk to a lot of people, but if you knew exactly who your early adopters would be, you could have just targeted those early on, right? But it takes time to do that. So maybe something for founders listening is to keep that in mind, right? Like, as you're doing your initial customer discovery, figure out, all right, who's likely to be the first person to try this out, right? Especially with all the newer technologies coming in. So I like this. I think this is quite interesting. One thing I did want to ask about the technology itself. So I think it's relatively understandable from a high level that the data that needs to be understood for environmental kind of permitting is probably somewhere there, and it's, you know, amongst databases, and that can be kind of just packaged and then brought as a software. But when it comes to developing these projects, especially in the case of renewables, how do you integrate with the other aspects of a positive project, right? One of the things I'm relatively familiar with is the interconnection capacity, right? You have to have capacity in the grid. So do you interact or kind of partner with these other softwares so that they can all work together? Because just because the permitting process might be easy doesn't mean it's a good site, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, from what we understand from our clients, and there's been some many articles on this too, kind of the trifecta of the biggest problems with renewable energy development right now is permitting, interconnection, and community sentiment. And so we do play, obviously, on the permitting side. We partner with another group that does a lot of work in the interconnection space to help solve that problem. And we also have a tool that's out in beta right now. It's our first AI-based tool called Solar Pulse that is helping give our clients insights into how a community might feel about solar development, because there's quite a bit of NIMBYism going on right now. We are either partnering or, again, being customer obsessed, finding solutions in-house that work for our partners to try to solve that whole suite of problems.
I think you reminded me of the one thing you said before, which is at some point the glass shattered on profitability, right? And I think that aligned around the same time that you're looking at these early contracts, maybe considering how to expand and how to, you know, what your future of your business looks like. So what was that experience like? At what point did you realize, wait a minute, we need partners. We need to bring more people to the table. There's more figuring out to be done.
Yeah, I think after we closed our seed round, I just had no idea what institutional funding could do and what having partners in is a climate fund. And so what having partners in that space could help me strategically understand about how to grow the business thoughtfully. So I don't think there was one moment when I realized I need partners, but looking back, I'm very thankful that I had them. I don't think our business would be in the same place today if I hadn't taken that leap of faith and ended up signing with those investors.
And so let's dive into that a little bit. How were you thinking about your seed round? Were you coming into it with, we need capital, we have this goal? I actually think, especially in my experience talking to founders, people think about their seed rounds in very different ways. Sometimes it's like, okay, we just want this much capital and we want VCs who to leave us alone. Or we need a VC to give us all of our introductions, right? You know, it's people have very different attitudes. So what was your mindset going into the seed round?
Yeah, again, I really didn't even know what I was doing. And I didn't even know what an institutional investor could offer to me. So, and because it had been, we weren't even out fundraising. It was an opportunistic connection. We didn't We didn't go get other term sheets. We didn't go out for a raise. They gave us reasonable terms. We said, sounds good. It was incredibly amazing. Later on when I had to actually go like hit the pavement for my Series A, I was like, oh, it is. It's a lot easier when the investor just comes to me and gives me a term sheet. Like I should do more of that somehow. I'm not really sure if I knew what I was looking for a seed investor, but now that I've raised a couple of additional rounds, I think what is the most important thing in looking at an investor, kind of like what I want out of a round is, yes, I want to be thoughtful that I'm not raising too much. That's one of the first things we do. And so we always do a pro forma here in house to make sure that like reasonable top line, what does it take to do that from an expense side and how can we scale that up or scale that down depending on how well the top line is going, right? Depending on macro trends and all that kind of good stuff. But I think kind of one of the soft skills that I would look for now, if I knew back then and what I would do now with an investor is like, do I want to have a beer with them? Because that can say so much. I mean, your investor, especially if they end up sitting on your board, can really influence like a founder's state of mind. And this is a very stressful role to be in. Like being a founder is incredibly Definitely. Stressful, and you don't need that piled on top with like a very stressful board of other stressful right. investors, right? And so finding board members that are, yes, super well connected, that's important. You want them to be able to, you don't want them to be distracting in a board meeting because they don't actually know what they're talking about, right? Like just the money guy is not really something I want because again, I think they could be distracting in a board meeting. You want them to have some strategic value. And I think empathy, we want them to have empathy. And I think that's where that beer thing comes from is you really want it. You really want, I mean, these people are part of your company. They're not just board members. And so you want to be happy to spend time with them because you're going to be doing it.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. One of my mentors, he recently put out a piece on the relationship between founders and their VCs. And it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the life cycle of a fund, right, and life cycle of a company, he used a stat which said the average marriage is about 8 years long. And I didn't know that, right? But if you think about that, if your company's around as long as the fund is, your relationship with your investor can be as long as a marriage, if not more, right? So sure. I know the exact beer test that you're talking about, but honestly, I think some people would take it even further. It's great to hear that for the many later rounds, subsequent rounds, you were able to incorporate that into your ideology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. One thing you mentioned earlier, and I don't know if it's still the case, but you know, you definitely were the first people building software for this space, right? So I don't know if you have competitors now. Obviously, you may comment on that or not. But if you're first in a space, how do you approach staying first? Because if you identify a really great opportunity, there's bound to be copycats coming after, right? So can you just talk about that mm-hmm. mindset? Because it's probably easy to get complacent, perhaps, or you know, maybe you let fear push you to continue to be better. Can you talk about that?
That's a combination of things. There's a few kind of just best practices we have here in-house. One of them, I'm beating it to death, but it's being customer obsessed and making sure that we're always focusing on product on what our customer wants, right? I've said that one. I'm saying it again because it's still applicable here. We also try not to focus too much on our competition because it can be distracting. And I feel like it's better to focus on that first tenet of being customer obsessed. And in all of our, you know, annual planning and strategic planning, we're always thinking about what's moat building and making sure that and making sure that we're maintaining quality. So our platform and our clients trust us because of the quality of our data. And so that is also a cornerstone of, I think, why we've maintained our place in the market is because there isn't anybody else that's maintaining the level of that we have here in house. And so that's, we maintain that as a tenant as well. And I think that those combinations of things have helped us from getting complacent, mm-hmm. but you know, we're always looking around us to see what's going on.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. So this kind of plays well into my next major topic I'd like to ask about, which is talent. So if you're going to be proactive and especially, you know, be customer obsessed, you need to have people who you obviously can't spend time with every single client, you know, engaging on a very regular basis with them. I'm sure you have some engagement, but you need people on your team who are doing that, who are thinking proactively about the next thing and who genuinely care to stay in the front, right? They're not just there for a job. So can you talk about talent and how you identify type of people that are going to be part of that culture, and then building and creating that culture from the ground and making it so that it stays around as you grow?
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word culture here because there's two different ways I could think about that, and it applies to how we hire. One is that we always hire now. We hire culture first. So when I started this company, I started it for kind of our outward mission, which was to balance conservation of the natural world with the needs of the built world. And the second was to build a company where people wanted to work. That's a bit more of the softer mission that we talk about here internally, but really important to build a company that people want to work because that's how you build this team that you want. We as a startup, we can't compete with the Google salaries and equity of the world, right? And so we have to compete with a place that you want to work. And so when we're hiring, those are similarly the two missions that we check for in our hiring to ensure that we're in alignment. So we get a lot of folks that come to us because they really love our mission. The climate transition, energy transition is really important to a lot of folks. And so we attract the folks that want to do something in the space that's meaningful and practical around energy. And so that is certainly a way that we hire talent. And we also, our key is that we won't ever hire you unless we've met you in person. So even in this remote culture, we always fly any candidate in because that is how we can understand if we're a culture fit. Other than that, we have a matrix of how we decide if they meet the skill set that we need. But I think those are the two key bits is we attract people because of our culture, which I'm really proud of because there was a while where I was pretty hands-off with culture. And as transparently and vulnerably here, I let it kind of like go to crap for a while because I wasn't really paying attention. I was building the business and wasn't paying attention. I was like, oh, we have unlimited PTO, right? Culture is done, but it's not. Like, there's so much more to culture, and we have to be a lot more intentional. And so over the last 15 months, we've actually done kind of an overhaul of our culture here in-house, and now we track employee NPS very closely, and we have the highest scores we've ever had. And so that's incredibly important to us, and that comes off in our hiring. And then, of course, we attract a lot of folks just because of our mission.
Yeah, I really appreciate that willingness to share that because I think it's extremely difficult to balance. You have co-founders, of course, it makes it a little easier, but when you're building a company, right, you got to make it work financially. You got to get the clients, et cetera. And it can be very easy to let culture go to the side because you probably spend the majority of your time, with the founders, and they're very, very early people. They are probably going to be mission driven because they wouldn't have joined you otherwise, right? They're not going to join some startup unless they have some kind of level of belief in what you're doing. But as time goes on, right, it can get complacent, right? And I think that's, props to you for being willing to admit it and to change it around because it takes a lot of humility for founders to do that when they oftentimes do not want to because they never want to be like, oh yeah, we did it wrong, right? But if you have that humility, you can change it around, and it obviously helps with the future growth. As a talent person, I've seen too many times where, the culture is probably really great for the first 10, 12 people, and then it like kind of plummets after they start growing, getting some traction because they get high on their own supply, right? But
that's right.
So okay, this is great. I guess we talked about fundraising, we talked about talent. We're kind of coming close to the end. So I want to ask, what is your advice to other founders looking to get into this space? I mean, you have a pretty interesting experience of building this company. So any particular advice you have for aspiring founders in this space?
There's a lot of advice that you could give because there's so much advice out there. I think for me, the things that always just stuck in my mind when I was either stuck or asking myself, why is this the path I have chosen for myself, like the path of most resistance to be a founder, is when you're stuck kind of on a business problem or on a what decision do I make next, especially around product. I read a book super, super early on in my founder journey called Exponential Organizations by Salim Ismail. And he has a kind of a theory in there about how I'm always making sure that whatever you're doing is 10x better than what's available right now. And that's always really stuck with me. And I think as an aspiring entrepreneur, I think that was important to learn because that falls into product market fit. And like, will you actually be able to scale your idea? Is it going to be 10x better than the current solution? Because that's what it takes for people to change their ways. Is the solution has to be exponentially better. So that's kind of one filter that I've used that I would admonish for aspiring entrepreneurs to think through before they decide to quit their day job. And then I think on the soft, kind of more the soft side of what I would say is to always keep that know your why. I think this is a phrase we use in industry a lot, know your why, because being a founder is really hard. It's not glamorous. It is like the opposite of glamorous. Everyone else who works at my company, it's really not glamorous. If it was in the bubble, I don't know about it. And we don't have that here. It's hard. And that's why culture is so important, is because when you're in the weeds with people, you want it to be with people that you trust, that you respect, that you're transparent with. You're going to hit a lot of delays, a lot of dead ends, and just kind of keeping that why in mind. The mission, for me, again, like, wanted to solve this interconnection of the built world and the natural world, and then build a company where people want to work. With those two tenets in mind, those are my why. And I would encourage any other founder to find the why that gets them through the hard moments.
Yeah, when Silas said we were almost at the end, I kind of got really surprised for a second, because this conversation's been great. And I think part of that too is you can see the emphasis on the why and the culture, especially as you talk through the problem, things like that, because, you know, whether people realize it or not, there are many ways to found a company, and not all of them are mission and purpose driven. But the thing that is definite for the people that don't do it that way is that sometimes those things definitely come back to bite you, versus if you drive it towards a mission and vision, you don't really have any qualms about how you went about it. And I think that's what we see from founders on this show. So I actually think it's really great that that's such a main focus for you guys.
Yeah. I'm going to try to cram in a couple other like high level topics right before we end here. One, you know, having built a software in a space that did not have a software for it, right? And you understand the renewables industry. I'm assuming you guys will expand to other industries at some point, but you understand the renewables industry well. When you look across the problems your clients have, what are some areas where you think that there's other opportunities for software to help solve solutions in the renewables project development lifecycle?
Let's see. I'm trying to think of a space where there's not already a solution. We're seeing, you know, I'm really excited about the future of energy transition because, to be honest, there is already so much innovation in this space. And honestly, to be perfectly clear, if I had a really great idea that wasn't already getting solved for, I probably wouldn't say it here because I'd want to start it as my next So I won't give away any of my dreaming. But you know, as far as what I think will probably happen in this space related to tech is that there is so much innovation, and a lot of it is in very vertical, like kind of inch wide, wild, deep spaces, like for us, environmental, and there's other groups that do land availability well and things like that. So I expect, because we do have so many kind of point solutions in this space, I expect in the next few years we'll start to hear our clients say more and more, I wish there was kind of like one platform to rule them all, to use a Lord of the Rings reference. And we'll see a bit more roll up in a kind of a less dense landscape of tech companies a few years from now. Yeah, I'm curious to see what else comes up.
Okay, I like that. I appreciate the answer. And then one thing, this comes back to something you mentioned at the beginning that I was just thinking about, and this may be hard to answer, but I still like these questions, is if you're able to save quite a lot of money on just this one particular aspect of developing projects, when all these kind of technologies get rolled out and refined and they work together, how, like, do you see the actual cost of, let's focus again on solar, the cost of solar energy coming down even further? Because I know it's really, really low already, right? But do you see it getting even even better? Or do you see it kind of, maybe there's a couple things that still have to happen that it will actually come up higher, and then because of the software, it'll stay level? I'm just curious if the general cost of projects will massively be reduced due to some of these, you know, kind of softwares coming in the market.
I think the general cost of both developing and operating is coming down, and I think it will continue to come down. So, like, I work on the pre-construction side. That's where our platform works really well in renewables. But I know there's also some really wonderful tech companies out there that are operating or that are kind of servicing on the operations and maintenance side around downtime for panels and construction, like quicker time to construction, things like that, like getting energy to market sooner, like kind of on a land development basis. So I think all in, we're on a great trend of tech is working in order to meet that energy transition goal faster. I think that the one thing we can't control in the private market, except on voting day, is how the regulatory space and the government is incentivizing energy. the energy transition. So everything is kind of up in the air for this year's election. I'm cautiously optimistic on how things are going to be in 2025 for the next administration. That is, if I had to pick one thing that I think could slow us down, it's politicians getting in our way.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate that. I think you answered my final question, was going to be what do you see next? But I think any other final comments for us to close us out? I mean, this has been a really great episode.
Yeah, no, I was really happy to be here. I think that energy transition is a really exciting space to be in. And I also really love talking about my founder journey. So I appreciate all the questions on how I built my business.
Yeah, I think it's great for people to get to share it, because otherwise, if you're not prompted, right, it just feels feels like you're boasting, right? But it's good to be able to look back, I think, and just consider, you know, the wins, right? I mean, it's for everybody, whether you're a founder or not, right? Taking some time to reflect is super important. I've been in New York almost 4 years now since I moved out here. And at the end of last year, I was, you know, thinking about it. It's just kind of crazy when you get to get a bit of time to really feel your accomplishments and let yourself feel the wins, especially as an entrepreneur. You're probably always pushing and pushing and pushing, and it's, you know, take a sip of coffee, you know, sit in a hot tub, whatever, you know, take a break, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so true. And we sit around and we say, I'm going to be, you know, on day one of when I started this company, we're going to be a success, right? What does success even mean? Like, does success mean an exit? Does it mean an IPO? Does it mean a profitable company? Like, I feel like I have success, right? I have a company that's changing the way renewable energy works. And I have a place where I employ 30 people that are happy to be here. And that to me means I'm a success. And so it is helpful to look back on what we've built here and all of the hard things that we've been through. I'm a completely different human being than I was when I started this 7 years ago. I can go through a lot more now. I have very different perspective. And so, yeah, I think it's been a success, but it is fun to reflect on the last 7 years. And had I known how hard it was going to be 7 years ago, it's like, would I have done this again? I don't know, but I think so. I like who I am now. I like the people I work with. I like the company I've built. So I think I would do it again.
Well, great. I mean, thanks so much for sharing that success with us. Just as we wrap up, where can the audience find you?
Easiest to get a hold of us through our website, transect.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing.